Monsignor Wadsworth is the General Secretary of the International Commission on Jewish in the Diocese and has been responsible for shepherding forward not just the missal, but has been an advocate of the cause of chant as an intrinsic and inherent and organic part of the Roman rite and should therefore be part of the missal that we use. He studied at Trinity College of Music, London. He was a singer and a pianist. He's a joint major. He did graduate studies at the Royal Academy of Music in choral conducting and piano accompaniment. For a year, he was at the English National Opera, where he was training singers. And he was ordained in 1990 for the Archdiocese of Westminster, and was appointed to this position at ISIL in 2009. And I must say, too, that he was a student of Mary Berry. I don't know how many of you know her. I've written so many tributes to her, based entirely on her reputation. She was in so many ways a student of that generation, you know, that came out of the early Salem period that was so optimistic about chant going into the Second Vatican Council and afterwards. And then everything didn't quite work out as they expected. But, you know, Mary Berry, she always looked to the future. And I think probably she understood that that future that she was thinking about was going to come about after her death. And that she was that kind of person. She thought about not just her future, but the future of the church, which is a different way of looking at things, isn't it? So because of this outlook that she had, she worked very, very hard to inspire everybody she came in contact with, not to just complain about things and can you believe the father won't let me sing the chant, or can you believe the bishop is in, blah, blah, blah. No, she was always optimistic, looking to the chant as a source of hope and vibrancy, for faith, and always emphasized the importance of integrating singing with living the Catholic faith. That was Mary Berry, and she left so many wonderful disciples after she died, one of whom is Monsignor Andrew Wadsworth. So in some ways he is kind of the embodiment of her legacy as well. And I think in some ways we should all look to her example. We don't know who we're going to influence, what we're going to do. Mary Berry left a legacy, and part of that legacy is the third edition of the Roman Missal. I want to see how these connections work. And certainly, Monsignor Andrew Wadsworth's work is inspired in so many ways by her, and tonight we're so pleased to have him with us to speak to us about the third edition of the Roman Missal. It's my great pleasure to introduce Monsignor Andrew Wadsworth.
Recipient of more superlatives. If you heard what I said in Atlanta almost a year ago, or if you've read it since, this is really a continuation of that thought. If you didn't hear it or haven't read it, I hope what I'm going to say will still be coherent. You will be familiar, no doubt, with the old adage that the eye is the gateway to the soul. I've always found this to be a most particularly persuasive idea, for it recognizes the fundamental fact that there is something deep within each of us that responds to beauty, whether it is wonder at creation or a response to art which captivates us. There can be very few of us who are not susceptible to perfection of form and the many things which delight us visually. Less popular is the idea that the eye is the gateway to hell. Immediately, we tend to feel a resistance to this notion, not only because it is seemingly such a negation of the former principle, but perhaps also because it so easily suggests that appearances can in some sense be deceptive, and that what we see may not be the whole story. As troubling as this concept may be, it does, however, acknowledge the complex and omnipresent reality that most of us are very easily beguiled by what we see. When we transpose these ideas into the arena of liturgy, the philosophical dilemma is noticeably exacerbated, for the liturgy is not solely visual, but rather engages all the senses. And in the same way, it is not only corporeal, but it also has an irreducible spiritual element. The liturgy, therefore, heightens in us an awareness of the intrinsic relationship between beauty and truth, just as it is of its nature, constituted of these elements, and should clearly become a vehicle for them when we celebrate it. Central to the mystery of the Christian revelation is the teaching that faith comes from hearing, and hearing through the word of Christ. In that sense, it is not only the eye which is the gateway to heaven, but in a very real sense, the ear too. As musicians, we need no convincing of this tenet, for it expresses our deep-seated conviction that what we hear cannot only engender faith, but over a lifetime can nourish and bring it to maturity. Nowhere is this more evident than our liturgical chant, which enables the word of truth to be expressed in the beauty of song in a way which is not adequately described by the comparatively sterile designation of the individual elements of words and music. In our Catholic tradition, liturgical chant is first and foremost cantillation, a song which arises from the text, a song which is essentially a heightened proclamation of a verbal message, and which takes its emphases from the natural accentuation of the text, and finds its melodic rhythm from the cadence which is already within the words. As it often sings of the glory of God, the wonder of creation, the richness of salvation in Christ, the mystery of the Church, and our continual need of God's mercy and grace, it is often an ecstatic song, which has rather more in common with the song of lovers than it does with the song of colleagues. It should have the familiarity of the song of those who are clearly of the same family, or those who are united as fellow citizens of the same territory. It is likewise never a song of violence, protest, or dissent, and it is overwhelmingly a song which is more about God than it is about us. So far, I have outlined what I believe to be the characteristics of liturgical song in the Catholic Church. It is, I would hold, not merely a subjective formulation on my part, but an accurate description of the character and function of liturgical song as inherited by the Church from the people of Israel in an unbroken tradition and set before the Church by the magisterium in every age up to and including our own. The challenge I wish to make is to ask if this is how you and most other members of the Latin Rite experience liturgical song, and if not, why not? If I were asking for individual responses to that question, which I'm not, I would imagine, rather than an immediate plethora of answers, there would be something of a thoughtful silence. For isn't it true to say that while we all recognize the elephant in the room, nobody particularly wants to address it? Given who we are and why we are here, and overcoming my natural British sense of discretion, I would like to make a tentative start in answering what is a rather thorny question. I would suggest that at the present time, liturgical song, as I have described it, is only consistently experienced by a relatively small percentage of Catholics. Even if it is also true that there are some individuals and communities who do experience it in this way on a regular or even continuous basis. The first reason why this is the case is that so many of our people remain essentially reticent when it comes to singing at Mass. A number of years ago, there was an insightful study by an American academic, Thomas Day, entitled, Why Catholics Can't Sing. I would imagine that most of you will have read it, as it has rapidly become established as something of a classic in this field. Day, a music lecturer at Salve Regina University in Rhode Island, accurately and scathingly takes a very considerable sideswipe at the Irish-American repertoire of songs that currently comprise Catholic liturgical music, not only in the USA, but also for the most part wherever Mass is celebrated in English. He goes on to identify a liturgical postmodernism, which he suggests has resulted in noisy and forced participation from the laity, and encourages a kind of church-wide narcissism that can represent a serious threat both to individuals and the institution of the church. Lest you should think that I'm exclusively a prophet of doom, Day also makes some very positive suggestions for nurturing the latent vitality he perceives within the Catholic community. Talent, which, as those most intimately engaged with the liturgy at parish level, you will all readily acknowledge. If you have read Thomas Day's book, you may well agree that it is an informative and often entertaining critique of a situation we recognise all too well. Although Dr. Day was writing over 20 years ago, many of his observations are still valid for the present time, just as much of his advice has gone unheeded in a liturgical culture, which is too easily driven by the exigencies of publishers, who for the most part are the architects of our liturgical repertoire, influencing choices of the liturgical music of which they are so often the sole purveyors. Let me be clear on this point. While I would want to register my appreciation for those publishers who are at the service of the Church's liturgy, I would also wish to identify a serious lacuna in our direction of a liturgical culture which has latterly been shaped by a repertoire of liturgical music principally determined by publishers. At this point, it is important to make a few historical observations which shed further light on this undesirable scenario. It would be a mistake to characterize this dilemma purely in terms of what has happened since Vatican II. Advocates of chant in particular have an annoying tendency to rewrite history in relation to what was common practice in our parishes until the late 60s, thereby contextualizing the debate in an unreliable nostalgia for something which was never really the case. For English-speaking Catholics, I think it's fair to say that a predominantly low-mass culture in which music is essentially an addition to the liturgy rather than intrinsic to it was already a centuries-old tradition at the time of Vatican II. In this respect, the current enthusiasm for chant and a growing competence in its performance, particularly in celebrations of the extraordinary form of the Roman Rite, is not so much a recovery of a recently lost tradition, but rather the realization of the authentic principles of the liturgical movement as canonized by Pope St. Pius X, in his motu proprio of 1903, Sra Solicitudine, underlining the centrality of Gregorian chant, guidelines which were largely unimplemented both at the time of the Council and in its wake. Some 60 years later, the pastoral liturgical movement, as it had become, had largely abandoned the principles which motivated Dom Guéranger and the renewal he initiated, in favour of influences which are more broadly ecumenical and introduce into the Roman liturgy elements which are more commonly found outside the Catholic Church. Nowhere was this influence more keenly felt than in the realm of liturgical music. For the principle that a repertoire of liturgical chant which had been proper to the Mass, at least in its most solemn celebrations, was largely and almost universally set aside, in preference for music which might be most accurately described as non-liturgical in character, given its frequent lack of dependence on liturgical or biblical texts, and its introduction into our liturgical celebrations of a voice which in many ways is alien to the spirit of the liturgy. It is vital to grasp that this is not only true of much music which is contemporary in style, but also evident in hymnody, which is so often of a devotional rather than a liturgical character, and which was transplanted into the Mass from non-Catholic forms of worship, which are constructed on entirely different principles. This is the modern-day inheritance of the Low Mass culture, which envisages a largely spoken liturgy, punctuated at key moments by congregational singing. For many Catholics, their core repertory of liturgical music will currently be mostly of this type. It is then supplemented by a range of responsorial music which need not be known as it relies on repetition. The notion of a form of liturgical music which is intrinsically related to the action of the Mass and which is in perfect concord with the nature of the liturgy, expressed in a repertory which both links us to the past and yet roots us in the present, still remains beyond the experience of most of our parishes and communities. Furthermore, there has grown up in our communities an expectation that liturgical song will frequently entail the assembly singing about itself. I had a powerful demonstration of this expectation last year in Atlanta while addressing a group of liturgical musicians about the implications of the forthcoming English translation of the Missal. I had used the opportunity to encourage initiatives among composers and musicians to look at creative ways of responding to the challenge of singing the proper of the Mass. In the questions which followed my address, one young musician responsible for the music in his parish said, "I hear what you're saying, but where are the wee songs?" He had a point. The texts of the Roman Missal, including the lectionary and the Graduale Romana, are generally lightweight when it comes to the community celebrating itself. If it is true that the past 40 years have established something of a hermeneutic of discontinuity with regard to liturgical chant, to the extent that our authentic and most ancient tradition is widely seen as alien and unfamiliar, and musical genres previously unthinkable in the liturgical context are commonly considered acceptable and even desirable, then we have truly lived through the most extraordinary revolution, which has impoverished our understanding of the mystery we celebrate to the same extent as it has decimated the number of our people who regularly participate in the celebration of the Mass. Another example may serve to illustrate how far we've deviated from the path. I have deliberately removed any details which will enable you to identify where this Mass took place. Suffice to say that it could reasonably have been witnessed in just about any large city in the English-speaking world. The occasion was a youth Mass involving a large number of young people of school and college age. The nature of the occasion meant that it would be reasonable to assume that the majority of those present could be described as practicing Catholics, at least in relation to their frequency of liturgical life. As the entrance procession of the Mass began, so did the entrance song. It was sung by a male singer who accompanied himself on the guitar, and he was joined by a female singer with a very nice voice. I did not know the song, something I've come to expect, but neither, it would seem, did anyone else present, despite the text of the song being reproduced in the participation aid. The only ones singing were the two singers I have already described. The song was certainly religious in content without being noticeably liturgical or scriptural in its text. Musically, it was entirely secular in character, but skillfully sung and played in a genuinely affecting manner. As this beginning to the liturgy unfolded, it became more and more obvious that this was a performance, and we were cast in the role of the audience. This information was further confirmed as the song ended, and it was greeted with enthusiastic and prolonged applause, curtailed only by the celebrant, beginning with the sign of the cross. This experience was repeated at several subsequent moments in the Mass, and notably during the Liturgy of the Word, at the preparation of the gifts, and during the distribution of Holy Communion. Each time, the dynamics were those of performance, and the liturgical assembly slid perceptibly into another mode, but one clearly familiar to young Catholics, that of the concert. At each subsequent moment, the pattern was repeated, and the performance was recognized by applause. Am I the only person who is profoundly ill at ease with this? Or can we identify that style, content, and delivery all determine whether our music is truly liturgical or not? Once again, it would be a mistake to identify this difficulty with purely contemporary musical styles. I have witnessed much the same phenomenon with traditional liturgical music in some of our great churches and cathedrals. In an attempt to balance up, I would like to cite another example. Once again, shorn of any identifying references, let us assume that it is a Sunday Mass in an average-sized parish. The focus of my interest in this second example is also a procession, but this time the communion procession. In this case, there is a cantor who introduces a simple antiphon, which the congregation easily takes up. The cantor supplies the psalm verses, and the singing of this communion chant continues throughout the distribution of Holy Communion, with everybody joining in, regardless of whether they are on the move or not. The result is very powerful and underlines the liturgical action effectively. The cantor directs the congregational singing in an unobtrusive manner, and the chant eventually subsides into quiet organ playing and then silence. The implementation of the English translation of the third typical edition of the Roman Missal later this year will be the biggest single moment of change for Catholics who worship in English in the 40 years since the revisions of the liturgy which followed the Second Vatican Council. It is a moment of unparalleled significance, not least because it represents a natural opportunity to reassess all that we do when we celebrate the Mass. The new edition of the Missal contains more music than any of its predecessors, and includes a complete set of chants for the principal parts of the order of the Mass. All the chants of the Latin original have been adapted to the English text. You will note that a guiding principle in the preparation of this translation has been the desire to render the fullest content of the original Latin in English which is fit for liturgical use. Greater attention to the scriptural resonances in these texts acknowledges Scripture as the largest single source of our liturgy. The elevated register of the language, the euphony of its phrases, and the cadence of its orations have all been prepared with the thought that most of these texts are by nature sung. For that reason, and without wishing to exclude the use of other genre where appropriate, the musical language of the Roman Missal is Gregorian chant. The general instruction of the Roman Missal echoes both Sacrosanctum Concilium and Musica Sacra in proclaiming that, all other things being equal, Gregorian chant holds first place because it is proper to the Roman liturgy. Other types of sacred music, in particular polyphony, are no way excluded, provided that they correspond to the spirit of the liturgical action and they foster the participation of the faithful. Attention to this latter quality in response to the implementation of the new translation should in due course, bring about a general change in the culture of our liturgical music. If that is the case, then it's long overdue. and will be greatly welcomed. In her pioneering work in promoting knowledge, understanding, and expertise in the chant, the founder of the Scola Gregoriana of Cambridge, the late Dr. Mary Berry, always took the opportunity to state her sincerely held scholarly view that chant was in fact part of the primitive kerygma, or deposit, communicated to the Apostolic Church in the first years. She held that the process whereby the Church identified certain scriptural texts with the celebration of particular aspects of the Christian mystery included the wedding of those same texts to music. In the case of the Old Testament, this would mean that we share a common musical patrimony with Judaism in a tradition that leads back to the temple and the chants sung by our Lord himself. She often said that this was most discernible in the liturgy of Holy Week, and had even supported this view by making recordings in her earlier years among Jews in the Middle East, showing such an origin for our prophecy tone and the chants of the Lamentations. Whether Mary Berry was right, or whether it was an educated guess, we cannot know. But her instinct certainly expresses the truth about our chant, which every generation has to discover for itself. This precious song, which has travelled continents and centuries in coming to us, this precious gift, which has embedded itself even in the fabric of Western music, is unique in its service to the spoken word, which it embellishes without obscuring, and explains without exhausting. This song of the saints, which is ever ancient and ever new, beautiful in its simple sophistication, accessible to all, and yet slow in yielding up its secrets, has its singers and its advocates in every generation, but is seeking new voices who will take it up in our time and ensure that the song of beauty and truth is heard even in this generation as a song of salvation and an instrument of God's grace. Thank you very much. Within their own territory. So some have taken that view. Well, I think that's been the general approach, but as far as I can see, the publishers and certainly the participation aids that have been across my desk so far seem to evidence that principle. So I think what you're asking, are these chants going to be easily accessible? Yes, they are.
So-called white list as approved hymn texts came before the General Assembly of the United States Conference, and before a noble effort by then Oakland Bishop Vigneron to refer this, the issue of all pride of texts and anything having to do with some worship to the Archdiocese of Portland and Chicago. To your knowledge, is that in the United States? You've mentioned before, you just mentioned in your address, that everything is being dictated by the publishers, but what I'm asking is, to your knowledge, are the bishops asserting their own rightful role in determining proper and fit Catholic worship, or is this, in fact, everything aggregated to those two dioceses, which happen to host the two major, the three major publishers?
I think that, as far as Debussy is concerned, that the chant of the Missa will be readily available, and I think that there's been a greater response to that on the part of the bishops than we might have imagined. I can't particularly comment on the policy of the US bishops, because I represent 11 conferences, and there's a variety of different approaches. And the chants of the Missal were offered to each of those conferences, and it was a great encouragement to me that they've all taken them up. They haven't all taken them up to the same degree, so some editions of the Missal in some countries have more of the chant than others do. I'm not aware of that discussion, at least in the sort of arena that I think would be significant. Obviously, the wider discussion of that issue, I think, is advancing all of the time. And I think a more faithful translation of the more recent Latin Missal is really perhaps a step towards us having a greater understanding of the process which has made that Missal, and having a greater realization of its contents, its advantages, and its disadvantages. Any more? Jeffrey?
What is the status of the Grotto Vella Romana as an official songbook of the Roman Rite?
It is an official songbook of the Roman Rite in its Latin text. It's produced by the monks of Salem, but it's published with the authority of the Holy See, the Congregation of Divine Worship. And it is one of the liturgical books of the Catholic Church. No vernacular edition of chants will achieve that same degree of authorization, which is easy to understand, I think, at the present time. But that might not be the case further down the line. But I imagine that behind that question, there's probably another question about the relationship between the text of the gradual and the text of the lectionary. I think there are many good projects underway at the present time that respond to that challenge. The challenge of providing us with material in English for the singing of the prophets. Some of those use lectionary texts, which will reproduce the responsorial psalm, perhaps the Gospel Acclamation, and will make use of missal texts of the entrance antiphon and the communion antiphon in relation to the chants. Some are now drawing upon the gradual texts and bringing about a harmonization of these two sources. I would have thought that that's something greatly to be desired. Thank you.
Yeah.
only a long way down the road, I think, that the missal has taken 10 years to make. The next largest text is the Liturgy of the Hours. I think the congregation is in meltdown just at the thought of that. Certainly that was the response I got when I suggested it. Next up is marriage, the rite of marriage and the rite of confirmation, and a supplement of the Liturgy of the Hours, which will give all of the texts of the proper feast, which have been added to the general calendar since 1973. And perhaps we might be able to sneak in all of the collects of the temporal cycle so that there could be a whole supplement volume which would make the present books of the Liturgy of the Hours usable with the new text. But that's a more immediate project. The Missal, of course, is the first text to be translated in accordance with the new norms. Everything else has got to be done now. So it's the first of a long series of translations. Thank you. Priests, lay people, musicians, catechists in relation to the new translation. I think people, once they realize that basically the new translation is going to be the vehicle for a greater amount of the content and meaning of the original texts, they get that. Now, I prefer to see that basically as a positive development rather than a correction. And it is a correction. There are whole ideas which just don't appear in our English translation, which are clearly evident in the Latin text. This translation attempts to address them. So the greater content of meaning, the restoration of a proper vocabulary of faith that we use in our liturgical texts. Of course, it's not everyday language. But we use these terms, and they're rich in their meaning. And if people don't necessarily grasp them initially, it just means we've got more catechesis to do. Thank you.
From a composer's standpoint, what access will composers have to the texts of the new translation? Specifically, I mean, obviously with the ordinary, but more importantly with the proffers,
complete access. Just to lay down, I suppose, some basic principles. The conference controls access to the text in its own territory. But I think there are going to be many portals through which this text is easily accessed. The revolution in information technology means that our whole understanding of this has changed. And I think that it's fair to say that the administration of copyright is in the process of shifting. And really, the major responsibility that ISIL has on behalf of the conferences is to ensure that people have the correct text. That the text that the people use and they publish in whatever form is in accordance with the typical edition. So that's a serious responsibility. As far as the collection of royalties in relation to the publication, if it's for parish use, if it's for personal usage, if it's in a non-commercial setting, there's certainly no question of there being any copyright fee to pay. And permission is always given, so long as the text is in conformity with the official text. If it's a commercial consideration, then I think that is a different concern. And one of the things that people have to understand is that a third of the conferences that are represented by ICEL are in places in the world that can't afford to produce liturgical books. For that to be a possibility, I've just had a case, I won't name the country, where we've enabled every priest in that country to have a new copy of the Liturgy of the Hours. It's a very large number of sets of breviaries. And that things like that are only possible because of the revenues that conferences collect, both in support of the production of the liturgical books and to be able to finance this whole concern on a worldwide basis. So that's an important part, really, of the administration of that responsibility. But in terms of your initial question, access to the text, I don't think, will be a difficulty.
So I guess a more specific question would be, if I, as a composer, wanted to, say, write a setting of the Proverbs and release it into the Commons, I could do that free of charge, as long as credit is given?
Yes, I mean, if it's a non-commercial concern,
exactly.
I don't think it's going to be a difficulty. But the ICEL doesn't control that access. That's controlled by the Bishops' Conference in the Imperial Territory. So, I mean, we work very much in harmony with the conferences. So we have to have a situation where we don't authorise something which the conferences don't wish to have, and the other way around for the most part. So it's a collaboration. Professor Mann. It's a private work of scholarship that bears the very individual marks of particular scholarship. It's not a new book of the Roman Rite. It's not an official liturgical book. But I mean, I think we're in a situation where I'm sure we're happy to see that scholarship moves forward as far as these. I would say, I mean, I sit in an office every day in DC that contains an archive of the notes, the contemporaneous notes made during the meetings of the Concilium that produced the liturgical books. Nobody's working on this archive. I spend my time speaking in university faculties and encouraging scholars to have access to this. I think the time for such scholarship is now. 40 years later, most of the protagonists are no longer with us. This is not a personal discussion. But we get to have the scholarship that really would support and discuss what happened after Vatican II. And that's probably just as true for music as it is for any other aspect of the liturgical reform. The last question, I think that we'll have to finish.
We've seen many changes to the liturgy in the last 40 years. Even since the publication of the third edition of the Roman Missal, there have been various amendments along the way, as late as 2 or 3 years ago. Do you see with the publication of this translation a period of maybe slightly longer stability for the ordinary Roman Missal?
Well, I think one of the challenges of the new translation and one of the possible worldwide benefits of it would be a more discernible common liturgical culture that unites, in this case, Catholics who worship in English. I found it very interesting that not even CMAA knew the response to the dialogue of the Gospel or the Memorial Acclamation 40 years later. What does this mean? Well, of course, it means we don't have a common culture of these things. But I think we're about to, potentially, at least among English-speaking Catholics, have a common liturgical culture. The Holy See has insisted that the same text is published in each of the 11 conferences, and with a body of chants that we will hold in common. Many conferences have decided to publish the chants both in Latin and in English. So that already introduces, visually in the book, the idea that the singing of Latin chant is quite normative in a celebration which is in English. To my mind, that itself is the most extraordinary step forward. We have to pray. There's lots of work to do, and we're going to be doing it. We're going to be doing it together, and I presume that, like you, I'm enthusiastic about that. And it will be the bringing to fruition of so many hopes over long years. And if you felt yourself to be marginalised in your situation, in your parish, nobody wants the music that our Schola offers, well, we find ourselves at the cutting edge of liturgical renewal. It's extraordinary, but it's God's work. God bless you.